Hi, I'm Yusuf Zine. My latest TVO Today podcast is on how a Canadian ends up in a Chinese prison and if he's even alive. Listen and subscribe to Extradition. Available now, wherever you get your podcasts.
This episode of This Being Human contains discussion on the partition of India. It was a time marked by violence, displacement, and trauma. The topic, understandably, could evoke distress or discomfort. Please take care as you listen. Welcome to This Being Human. I'm your host, Abdurrahman Malik. On this podcast, I talk to extraordinary people from all over the world whose life, ideas, and art are shaped by Muslim culture.
I want to do something great that makes my heart stir, that makes other people's hearts stir. And so I want everyone to have that experience, but I want also me to have that experience as well.
Kiran Ahluwalia is a true innovator, someone who pushes boundaries and blends cultures to create truly unforgettable music. She's an award-winning vocalist, a composer, and a master of fusing the rich traditions of Indian classical music with the energy of blues, rock, and a good dollop of West African soul. Kiran's music is a captivating journey, using the music from her native Punjab to explore themes of cultural identity, social justice, and the human experience writ large. We deep dive into her creative process, learn about how her music breaks down barriers, and ultimately, how it brings people together. So settle in and get ready to be inspired by the artistry of Kiran Ahluwalia. I'd like to start with Pancake. Mm-hmm. I love your latest single, Pancake, but I have to admit that when I first saw the title, I thought I read it wrong. And it's a funny, mischievous track, eminently danceable too, as well. I love the kind of the humanness and the rawness of the video. But I want you to tell us a little bit about how this song came to be. Tell us the story of how you came to write a Punjabi song called Pancake.
Exactly, Pancake. Well, over the last, 10 years, maybe 8 years, there is a trend in Punjabi music where they use English words. You know, the word Obama, swag, Lamborghini, And I just thought of Pancake. And I wanted it to be a fun song, a love song, because a lot of Punjabi upbeat songs are fun and about love or some aspect of love or some aspect of chasing your beloved in a very like coquettish, like, you know, fun way. And so I just thought of this one time that my husband, who's my guitarist and my producer, Reza Bassi, he and I were boyfriend and girlfriend, and we were vacationing in Puerto Vallarta. This is over 20 years ago. And so we're at an all-inclusive, and I look over at him, and he is rather forlorn and disheartened and looking all sad. I look down at his plate, and his pancakes are finished. And it's an all-inclusive. You can eat whatever you want, but he's just looking so sad. And I said, well, you can have my pancake. And he said, I love you. And it was so sincere. And it's just not that. That's been a theme in our marriage. I offer him something sweet, and he says, I love you. And so I thought, like, this is a good thing to write about. And so I incorporated his personality into it as well. He's not an aggressive human being. So in one of the stanzas, it says, he approaches me slowly, like timidly, himself blushing. So that's very much his personality. He's not actually blushing, but he's very... He's just, you know, he's got this very, like, kind of, like, slowness and timidness and non-aggressiveness about him. And another way I incorporated his personality into it is I said, my love for him is Zabardast. And Zabardast is this word in Urdu and Punjabi that is just, like, you don't usually use it for love. You use it for other things.
That's right, but it's such a beautiful use of it in your song. Like, it really hits you. Like, it's one of those words in our language that is, like, super emotive, right? When something is Zabardast, it is a real exclamation.
Exactly. You usually use it for, like, a performance or something. But I'm saying my love for him is Zabardast, and...
I love it.
It's so great that, you know, forget about the great Bulle Shah, who was a Sufi poet... I myself become a poet. Like, I myself start writing poetry.
I actually, that line about Bulle Shah is such a great line.
Thank you.
And kind of really underscores the mischievousness of the track itself. That, you know, Bulle Shah is at the very heart, isn't he? This great Punjabi Sufi poet shared by all of our traditions. Tell us a little bit about the centrality of poetry, and particularly the poetry of folks like Bulle Shah in our Punjabi cultural tradition. Because I think once we got a sense of that, then we know how mischievous you're actually being.
Yeah, well, thank you for liking that line. My editor, he liked that line. So Bulle Shah is a 16th century poet. And he was a Sufi poet living in the region that it now falls into Pakistan. And we say Sufi poet because he wrote about love, but he also wrote about love for the divine. But it is very much about forgetting oneself, about not knowing who you are, about discovering who you are. And... He's, you know, one of the great poets of Punjabi literature. And so, yeah, you know, I've got my tongue in my cheek when I say that your love creates such magic. What it does to me is that, forget about Bulle Shah. I myself start writing poetry.
I think Bulle Shah would have been very pleased with that line. Because, like you said, that poetry is all about, you know, who knows Bulla? He says it is poetry, right? Who cares about Bulla? And he's always talking about, you know, the beloved. And I just thought that your lyric, like, it just opened up this kind of, you know, this line of thinking. In a way, Karen, you are continuing the tradition of mischief.
Thank you.
Do you see yourself as a kind of a mischievous, playful composer, lyricist, musician?
In some songs, for sure. You know, I don't usually do an album that is focused on one thing. It's so hard to talk about things that are complex. This album is focused on this, but that's just not the reality of it. There's a whole bunch of things happening in this world, absolutely terrible things. And then, you know, absolutely wonderful things as well. So when I'm writing the Punjabi folk songs, I do my more upbeat stuff in the Punjabi folk songs. I definitely bring out that mischievousness. But a lot of this album is also focused on the current rise of Hindu fundamentalism in India and in the Indian diaspora here in Canada and America. And, you know, those songs are a call to everyone to realize that we are from the same root. If you cut you, you cut me, we have the same shade of red that comes out of us. We have the same salty tears. So it's a myriad of emotions. My music reflects all the emotions that I go through.
There's also this theme that I've noticed, having listened to you for a long time and loved your music.
Thank you.
And I think one of the things that kind of emerges for me album after album is this theme of tradition and innovation, right? Like I can hear it. It's there. It's the Punjabi music that, you know, I grew up with, that I love in my bones. And then there's that element like, ooh, okay, that's different. That's exciting. When did you first start playing between different genres and seeing what would work and how it would sound?
To me, I don't really even thinking I'm mixing tradition anymore, because tradition is such an ambiguous word. Mm-hmm. Does that mean music the way it was done 100 years ago, 300 years ago, 50 years ago? What does traditional actually mean? Yeah, I'm singing in Punjabi, but that's a very contemporary language. So is that traditional? Punjabi music is a contemporary genre. So that's not really traditional. It's not Western, but it's not traditional either. So I find that a problematic word, traditional. I'm doing contemporary Indian music that is mixed with sounds of India and the sounds of the West.
I love it. And not only the sounds of the West, right? Your influences are truly global. There's this, you know, this wonderful kind of adjective that you use in describing your musical style. You call it kind of Indo-Saharan. How does that compositional style, the Indo-Saharan, the contemporary bringing together of different sounds and making them work, how does that happen in you?
I fell in love with West African music. And Tenariwan was my gateway into that. They are Muslims from Mali and Algeria, from the Sahara Desert. They're nomads. I thought, let me do something that is classic from the Islamic world. So I did the classic Pakistani Qawwali, must. And I thought that that would be something new for people who've already heard the Qawwali in South Asia, because they probably haven't heard it with this West African angle of electric guitars, exactly the way Ibrahim plays the electric guitar. Mm-hmm. And so it'll be a new take for them. It's a woman singing it, which, you know, that version of must, I never have heard any other woman sing it. And it'll be definitely something that Tenariwan will be familiar with. They're familiar with the call and response that happens in Qawwali. They're familiar with the claps that happen in Qawwali, because they also have hand claps and they also have call and response in their own music. So these two elements will be familiar to them. The words, Ali, Muhammad, all of this will be familiar to them. And I thought that's how I ended up choosing that song. And then after that, there wasn't any thinking. Like, we got into studio together in Paris, and just like, you know, we sat down in a small room to rehearse. That was supposed to be just a rehearsal day. Within the first hour of rehearsal, the producer, Justin Adams, who works with Robert Plant, within the first hour, he said, let's put up the mics. We're recording this now.
I mean, your music runs, as you talked about earlier, kind of the gamut of emotions. And there's something about this folk music that we can connect to in visceral ways, and even beyond language, right? You know, folks don't have to understand Punjabi or Urdu or Hindi and are incredibly moved when they hear you sing. And that, to me, speaks, Karen, of what I feel is like an underlying and powerful connection to a spiritual and cultural heritage. How does your own Sikh background and your Punjabi culture inform your artistic expression?
The Sikh religion has a lot of music in it. Our temples are called gurdwaras, and they do a great marketing job. I mean, it's a religion that was started 350 years ago. Even back then, their marketing was great. And I say that because the religion has combined music and food with the temple, with the gurdwara, and sugar. So gurdwaras have what they call, like, they're groups of three men who are doing music. And that music is like nothing that you've ever heard in the world before. And then you get this like sweet dish called prasad. So you have like your sugar, and then you go down and you have like this amazing South Asian meal, Punjabi meal. And yeah, you also get closer to God. And I mentioned that last in exactly that order. And so as a child, I had music in my life through my religion. I was also listening to the radio in India, listening to Bollywood. So I also had that. So the Sikh hymns, which we call Shabad, they were one aspect of my musical education. I'm not a tremendously religious person. I have a very love-hate relationship with God. Sometimes I believe, sometimes I don't. I do know that when I am in distress, I still turn to communicating with God, and the way I've been taught how to communicate are through the Sikh scriptures. So I will, like, you know, use them to sometimes communicate with God or to go to the Gurdwara to get peace of mind. And every time I go to Gurdwara, I definitely have peace of mind.
What was the music that was being played in the Ahluwalia home as you were growing up? And I wonder how that music changed when you came to Canada.
The music that my parents listened to were ghazal. Ghazals are a form of love poetry that originated in Persia, traveled to India, and are very much Indian. Like the Indian ghazal, Pakistani ghazal, is very much different than the Persian ghazal. So they listened to a lot of ghazal. Then they also listened to a lot of 70s Bollywood, you know, in the 70s as I was growing up. And Shabad, which is the, you know, Sikh spiritual hymns. And then they would have musical parties. So when they had parties, my parents...
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah, a lot of their friends were purposely people who liked music. So before we had dinner, we would go around and people who can sing to some degree would sing.
I love it.
So my mother would sing a song. My dad would sing a song.
Wow.
Other adults would sing a song. Not everybody had to participate. And I, as a child, would actually sing a song. And then when we came to Canada, that did continue. In the 70s, the Indian concerts or Pakistani concerts at that time, the community had not come of age at that point. And so a lot of these concerts would happen in people's homes, in their basements, and the word would be spread word of mouth by phone call. Like, you know, the person having the concert would literally get on the phone and call 300 people. You know, and, you know, 100 would show up and you would buy tickets, and it didn't have to be a person, you know, you found out about the concert somehow and you'd purchase a ticket and you go to the stranger's house in their basement and you would hear Ghulam Ali or Jagjit Singh, these stalwarts of the ghazal genre, singing in a basement.
Incredible.
Like, you know, like 1 feet away from them. I heard them 1 feet away from them.
That's wild, Karen. That's wild.
It's a wonderful memory. And in the intermission, you would be served this wonderful masala chai and samosas. And then, you know, the concert would continue. And I would always be the only child at these concerts. Because even though at that time I did not understand all the words of the music, there was something about the music that I just loved. And love, it doesn't even, it's a word that has lost its power. I connected to the music. It made my soul and my heart vibrate in a way that nothing else made it vibrate. So that's how, you know, they continued.
And then was there a point that you started, did you start like formal training in music? Were you already learning musical instruments? Like, how does Kiran Ahluwalia take that connection, that love, turn that into like your craft?
So my parents were hobby musicians. They competed in their colleges in India. So they were my first teachers of music. And then they hired a music teacher to come to my home in India to start teaching me music. So I started learning music formally at the age of 5 in India. And then when we immigrated to Canada, they found a teacher in Toronto and I continued learning. So I continued learning music part-time all the way from school to university to my first job in Toronto. And then when I had my first job, I felt like I could see my future if I was just to continue doing what I'm doing, which is to continue on this corporate ladder and get a managerial job. And I could see myself having a home in the suburbs. And I could see like the color of the carpet. It would be dusty rose. and have a dog and kids. And so that's when I thought of, you know, myself being 90 and on my deathbed. And what is this corporate ladder climbing? And what is that all going to mean to me? Is that going to be a life lived that I loved? And the answer was no. So I wanted to do what I wanted to do. So then I quit my job and I went to India to be a full-time music student. Mm. I was in India for like a year, year and a half. Then I would come back to Canada, make some money, work for CBC, work for Saturday Night Magazine, go back to India, come back to Canada, make some money. Did that for about 15 years.
Karen, that is immersive.
Yeah.
That's an incredible story. What a remarkable achievement, Karen.
Thank you. It was tough. So it was a calling, definitely. It was a passion, but there's got to be a little bit of insanity in that cocktail. because, you know, this was my first year in India was 1990, a full-time, doing full-time music. There were no cell phones. And in India at that time, if you wanted a landline, you had to wait 10 years for it. So I had no phone. I didn't have a TV. And I was living alone in Bombay. And because I was doing 7 days of music, 8 hours a day, I had no time to make any friends. Even if I had time, there was no way to make friends. So it was an incredibly lonely time. But at the same time, I was very, very happy. And at that time, I thought, this is just 1 year. I'm going to do music for 1 year. I'm going to come back to Canada and I'm going to go back into the corporate world. So it was very special for me.
I have a small favor to ask you. If you enjoyed this show, there's a really quick thing you can do to help us make it even better. Just take 5 minutes to fill out a short survey. This is the Aga Khan Museum's first ever podcast, and a little bit of feedback will help us measure our impact and reach more people with extraordinary stories from some of the most interesting artists, thinkers, and leaders on the kaleidoscope of the Muslim experience. To participate, go to agakhanmuseum.org/TBH survey. That's agakhanmuseum.org/TBH survey. The link is also in the show notes. Thank you for listening to This Being Human. Now, back to the interview. Compassion and empathy appear all over your work. And I think back to what you were just saying about this kind of journey, the musical journeys that you took in South Asia between India and Pakistan. That must have taken you to all kinds of, you know, to the Sufi shrines, to the dargahs, to the mandirs, to the temples of different traditions. And it must have been fascinating through the music to be able to sample and to pick up the resonances in each of those places. Did those kind of formative experiences kind of shape this kind of mission of compassion, empathy, and connection that is so much part of your music now?
Life in itself has brought that compassion. And it's key people, my Ghazal Guruji, Vitthal Rao, he's the one I credit with making me a composer. My classical Guruji Padma Talwalkar in Bombay is the one I credit with my voice being what it is, the way I throw my voice, the way she opened up my pipes. You know, they're constricted as a layperson. You know, she opened up my pipes to let the air flow, and my voice is what it is because of her. I'm a composer because of Vitthal Rao, and he's the one I would also credit most with bringing empathy, with figuring out how to have a thought, how to have empathy or how to have a thought and how to bring that into a composition and how to bring that into a style of singing. But other than that, it's a very hard question to answer as to where the empathy comes from. It's a conscious choice to bring that into one's music.
It's the intentional way, you know, that you bring traditions together, as you were describing the way in which you collaborated with Tanarwan, there's a lot of care. It feels very profound, Karen. It feels like it's coming from right here, right from the heart.
Thank you. But there's definitely a very selfish reason for it. I want my music to sound good. I want it to be a really good project. So, I mean, you know, I want to do something great that makes my heart stir, that makes other people's hearts stir, that makes Tenarion's heart stir. And so I want everyone to have that experience, but I want also me to have that experience as well.
I love that. Karen, before we kind of move to our final question, you know, you're now over 2 decades in the music business, you know, decades before that, you know, a decade and a half at least of training.
Okay, so when you say business, I'm going to say nonprofit.
No.
Nobody's making any money doing the kind of music I do.
This is the point at which I should have a very good, like, Punjabi mahavra about, like, where does true wealth come from? But my Punjabi is so, as friends who speak Punjabi tell me, my Punjabi has 2 broken legs.
So you're from Multan and you guys speak Punjabi?
We do. We actually, my father was born in Amritsar and my mother's family is from Jalandhar. And so my father's family spoke Amritsari Punjabi straight. And my mother's family spoke Jalandhari Punjabi straight. This actually was an issue when my parents were getting married, because it was like, how can Jalandhari Punjabis and Amritsari Punjabis actually understand each other, even though the language is basically the same?
And so then, where's Multan? Where's Multani?
So after the partition, my father's family eventually settled in Multan and became adopted Multanis. My grandfather learned Saraiki as well, the language of southern Punjab. And my mother's family moved to Rawalpindi. And so my mom was actually born in Rawalpindi.
My dad is from Pindi. My dad's a Pindi boy.
Is he?
Yes.
Did he move in 47 to India?
Yes, they moved in partition to India. So at that time, my dad's father, my dad would have been like something like 9 or something. Mm. And at that time, his father and mother were already in what was going to be India.
Right.
After a post-partition India. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the kids, like 5 or 6 of the children, including my dad, were in the house in Rawalpindi. Mm. And so the riots had started, and my father and his brothers and sisters would go up on the roof and they would collect rocks and broken bottles to throw on the crowd to keep the crowd from coming to them. They were terrible times. And then my father's father, my grandfather, said, let's call the kids over to the Indian side for now. Mm. And we will return to Rawalpindi once the violence subsides. So my father and his siblings got on a train that would end up with a lot of corpses, and they got to the Indian side thinking that they would return to Rawalpindi in a month. And my father returned to that house 52 years later when I took him there when I was on tour in Pakistan.
What an incredible moment that must have been for your father.
Yeah, for both the house owners, because the house went to the owner's daughter. So we walked in, and so she had the house that, you know, was ancestrally my father's house in the land swap that happened, this huge, complicated land swap. And we walked in and we explained who we were. Mm-hmm. And she said in Urdu, "Main aapki intezaar kar rahi thi," which translates as, "I was waiting for you." And it's so emotional. And, you know, it's emotional because the two countries have been in a Cold War and a de facto war and a real war since partition. But the people of both countries have so much love for each other. And we are brothers, and partition was the loss of a brotherhood.
As you're speaking, Karen, I feel the emotion of the story because, you know, we too, and my grandparents too, had that experience, particularly my grandmother, my nani, who was quite young and had a stepson at that point. She was in her late teens. And, you know, the life that she knew was this incredible village life in Jalandhar, you know, a Muslim village built around the shrine, you know. And she came in the other direction from Jalandhar to Lahore. And she was in one of those infamous convoys, you know, 17 miles long, where, you know, the back of the convoy would reach where the front of the convoy was. And there would be the signs of horrific violence. And unfortunately, no member of either my father's family or my mother's family has ever been able to go back to Jalandhar or Amritsar. I once had a visa, and then the border closed. That was the closest that we got. And, you know, I was lucky enough, I guess, to speak to my grandfather before he passed, and he would describe the neighborhood and the mosque, and I found them all on Google Maps. You know, I've looked at it electronically. I've said, oh, there's the masjid, and those are the streets where Dada and my pardada would have lived. And I even found, after many years, because my nani didn't really read and write, and so it was all memories, and she had the name of her village, and it was a name that didn't quite make sense to me. And then I found it. I found the village, and I found, you know, she had mentioned, in the village there was this mazar of a Sufi saint, and I found the mazar all, you know, like
kind of electronic. What was the village?
It is called Adaraman, and it's on the banks of one of the rivers. And she would always joke with me, because my name is Abdurrahman, and she would always joke with me. She goes, beta, my village, you know, it was named after you. And I said, Nani, I wasn't even around then, because they kind of knew. So as you say, Adurrahman is like Abdurrahman. So she would call me her Adurrahman, you know, endearingly, which is just, you know, the experience of partition, to have that experience, to be there with your dad, and to have experienced that kind of love and connection, moves me to tears, and it's really powerful, and it is so hope-giving. And I don't think it was until much later in life, and I wonder how it was for you, that I think contended with how much the experiences and the traumas of partition influenced all the decisions that our families ended up making, and in so many ways influenced the way even that we see the world. Like, I think about, oh, you talk about connection. What a beautiful connection to return to that home, and for the person who's in that home to say, "Hum aapka intezaar kar rahe the, we're waiting for you." What a powerful human, beautiful heart connection, generosity, hospitality. And as much as I think partition teaches us about violence, it also teaches us that in the face of violence and separation, we find connection. And I wonder how much partition sort of influences our own paths. I would venture a fair bit.
Definitely for us. So my theory is that the people who lived through partition, like my parents and my husband, I'm sorry to make you cry.
Not at all. No, you don't have nothing to apologize for, but it's appropriately evocative. And important to your story and my story, to our story.
And here I am using my own tissue paper. So my take on it is that the people who lived through partition, like my parents, who went into post-partition India, and my husband, Rez Abbasi's parents, who went into post-partition Pakistan, they lived it. And so they saw the violence firsthand. They experienced it. And because they experienced how horrific human beings can be, they saw the loss of humanity. It's that made them think that this cannot be repeated. This inhumanity cannot be repeated. We are one of the same. And my parents, when I was growing up, and even in my young adult life, never mentioned the atrocities of partition to me.
Same, Karen.
Yeah. Yeah. When I went back to Pakistan and I took my dad back to Pakistan, that's the first time he told me about what happened in partition. So my parents never passed down any hatred for the other side to me. And that is what allowed me to fall in love with someone from the enemy country, Pakistan. And that is what allowed my parents and his parents to come together, to love each other. No Bollywood drama in our wedding. Whereas when I meet people from other areas of North India that did not experience partition in the same way, where their trauma has not been passed down generationally from their parents, they have more of a hatred for Pakistan. Mm-hmm. And similarly, you know, Pakistan, those similar Pakistanis that haven't experienced that partition have a hatred for Hindustan, for India. So it's very, very, very difficult when I talk to people in India who have this, you know, who think of people, the two of us as different people. It's very difficult. I would say I found it impossible to show people that we're the same.
Well, your music, Karen, continues to do so much in terms of that connection and compassion. And, you know, I think these partition stories give us an insight into the kind of people we become and the kind of work that we do. Karen, tell me about a joy or a meanness that came to you recently as an unexpected visitor.
I'm going to say it's the joy is me singing about the fact that we are one people. And what's a recent joy? Making the videos for my new songs has been a wonderful, wonderful joy. We went out into the Mojave Desert, 3 hours outside of Los Angeles, to shoot the video Tera Jag. And that was a wonderful feeling. It was really amazing. And music itself is the joy.
Karen, that was really lovely. Thank you. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Abdulrahman.
Karen's new album, Comfort Food, which includes the song Pancake, just came out and is available wherever you stream music. This Being Human is presented by the Aga Khan Museum. Through the arts, the Aga Khan Museum sparks wonder, curiosity, and understanding of Muslim cultures and their connection with other cultures. This Being Human is produced by Antica Productions in partnership with TVO. Our senior producer is Imran Ali Malik. Our associate producer is Emily Morantz. Our executive producers are Laura Regeer and Stuart Cox. Mixing and sound design by Phil Wilson. Our associate audio editor is Cameron MacGyver. Original music by Boombox Sound. Shagoyeg Tajvidi is TVO's managing editor of digital video and podcasts. Lori Few is the executive for digital at TVO.